Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Our guest this week is James Clement. James is a seasoned rancher and innovative leader in ag tech, currently serving as Senior Vice President of Grass and Range Land at Earth Optics. James's family have nearly 400 years of combined family ranching experience, including operations like Biggs Cattle Company and King Ranch. James also founded his own cattle company in Kingsville, Texas, called Bloody Buckets Cattle Company, a hat tip to the 28th Army Division. James is currently serving in the Marine Corps Reserves with more than 17 years of service. Like most competitive younger brothers, James still wanted to join the Marines to follow his brother, but he wanted to enlist in the Reserves instead, while his brother pursued the officer route through the Naval Academy. Fortunately or unfortunately, however you look at it, James ultimately ended up as a Marine officer. But this set off one of the more interesting military careers I've ever heard of. An Afghan deployment in 2011, a military transition team or MIT team training Mexican lieutenants in Mexico for 5 months, and then leading an Afghan refugee camp outside of Fort Pickett in Blackstone, Virginia for 3,000 refugees. Have a listen as James and I weave our way through this fascinating military career and end up at his current position with Earth Optics. The work they're doing with soil health monitoring and their use of a variety of different technologies to gather this data is quite differentiated in this space.
Both sides of my family have been ranching a long time. So my dad's family with King Ranch in South Texas, and then my mom's family with Beggs Cattle Company in North and West Texas. And outside of ranching growing up, went to school, and then post school, my brother was in was going to Naval Academy for his college, my younger brother. And while I'd graduated and was gone to Australia and to Florida and then back in West Texas now working, he was talking about all the stuff he got to do in the Marines, like gearing up towards graduating Naval Academy. And I was just thinking, I don't want this to pass me by. So when I was 22, I enlisted in the Reserves so I could keep ranching. And then it kind of developed from there. But that's about a quick run through my childhood, I guess.
How did your brother get initially connected to Naval Academy?
We both played lacrosse in high school. I went and played D3 lacrosse in Baltimore, a little school called Goucher. And then he was better, so he went to go play for Naval Academy. And you know, we both liked our time in Maryland. You know, both played varsity lacrosse all 4 years of our college. And, but really that's a big part of it is Navy was a powerhouse then. And, he got recruited to go play out there. And then, you know, when you're in that kind of community, you start to see all the other opportunities that are out there. The Naval Academy, even though I wasn't there, but for your parents, it does a good job. All the service academies of slowly, indoctrinating children over 4 years rather than just whip you through boot camp and okay, you're ready. But so again, watching him do that course, I wanted to be enlisted just to try a different path.
So when he joined when he went to the Naval Academy, it was primarily to play lacrosse. And then at what point did he decide or did he realize, oh, I can be a Marine on the back end of this, or did he go Navy?
No. Yeah. He went Marine F-18 pilot. Okay. And he just, so that, again, that was, I think we all growing up prefer Marines, you know, and,
that's one way to put it.
Just, they're really good at marketing to young men. And, but he got to meet some good leaders, some senior enlisted folks that were there at the Academy. And then as I was exploring and talking to the recruiter back in Texas, it was the same way, just, you know, that was the team I wanted to be on.
Man, I've had a bunch of these conversations and folks that grew up in similar environments that it sounds like you have, ranching, you know, from an early childhood, both sides of your family. view it from two different perspectives, right? Either I can't wait to get away, or I can't wait to participate in this in some capacity going forward. What was that like for you at the time as a young kid ranching from what sounds like as early as you can remember? Was it something you wanted to continue to do, and why was it that you felt so passionate about it?
I'm obsessed with this question, actually, because now I have a son and a daughter, hopefully more children later, and I see some of the best cowboys and some of the best, you know, potential ranchers out there get burned out at an early age, just like we've seen, you and I've seen some of the best Marines, right? You hit them too hard too soon those first few years, and then they get out, and then either they or the Marine Corps will miss them forever. But so on the ranch side, my dad, my parents, but my dad in particular did an incredible job of, you know, psychological influence, I guess. I don't think intentionally, but he kind of, it was the slow drip. He's, you know, well, how about that? But when I was 10 was the first time I actually had like an actual summer job. And it was just for a few weeks. And then it seemed like every summer it was just a few more days or a few more weeks. And it never felt like a job. It just felt like it was the thing to do. Like I got done with the school year and went out to the cow camps. And then as I was going through school, you know, once the sports and everything kind of took over, still ranching every summer, but, you know, then got into playing lacrosse and going to college to do that. So, but ranching was always there, more in the background, I guess. And then when I graduated college, there, King Ranch used to have a lot of interns come through, especially foreign interns. And I met an Australian, Marcus Andrews. He went by Biltong, which is what they call jerky in Australia, and because he was a skinny guy. And I got to work with him to go down to work for a company called Consolidated Pastoral, which is a huge operation, used to be owned by Kerry Packer and managed by Ken Warner down there. And I could really point to when I realized I wanted to make a career out of ranching was when I was there. And sometimes just like, again, in the military, sometimes it takes you getting out of your comfort zone or getting somewhere completely different to realize how good you had it or how much you liked what you were doing or what you want to do. And it felt the same way with ranching. So I came back from Australia, committed to ranching as a career. Now I still joined the Marine Corps after that, because that was an itch that needed to be scratched, and I'm continuing to scratch it from the reserves now. But that was a big part of it. I think it's, you know, just that influencing, and my parents were really good about exposing us and not being those heavy-handed parents that said, you will do this. It was just, you will do something and a variety of things. And then if you're going to do it, you're going to go all the way. And I think that was a great way to develop, you know, where I am today, I guess.
How old were you during that experience in Australia?
22.
Was there more to that you'd share that was like at a particular, was it just the whole experience, or was it, you know, some nuggets that you can extract from that where you started to really cement that desire?
Well, Australia has a difference. They've done a really good job recruiting green, what they call jackaroos, the you know, first year cowboys to come from the East Coast, from the cities, and just go out there. And they send them to a 2-week cowboy camp. Huh. And they get out there. But I was 22, and I was probably the third or fourth oldest guy on a cow camp that was managing 2.5 million acres, Carlton Hill up in the Northwest. And I mean, most of it was 19 year olds doing their skip year between high school and college, which is another great program they have down there where they all kind of almost mandate that people take a year between high school and college to make sure either get an experience or work a little bit in the industry they want to be in. And so one, it was great to be around people, I think, my age and see their enthusiasm and realize how lucky I think we are back home, because both sides of my family are in this. But two, I mean, you can imagine, I don't think we worked a herd that was less than 1,000 cows, and they averaged almost 2,000 cows. Big cattle drives, you know, 10 or 15 people driving 1,500 to 2,500 head across salt flats, which look like a desert, and through kind of austere terrain all over. And people that were on a path to get education, to you know, or to do something completely different, but wanted to, you know, want to check that box, whatever. And again, it just made me realize how fortunate we are back home. So I think that all came together. The Australians too do a really good job of implementing. I think part of it's due to some of the government grant money for the ag that is more energetic, I guess, than we have it here. But they add technology, or they were adding technology, it felt like, a lot sooner than a lot of the operations were here. Hmm. I feel like now there's more of a head-to-head race, but you were seeing a lot more of that. And then again, I'm in ag tech now. And so I'm not saying that that's why I'm in it now, because that was almost 20 years ago, but it was all these things influence, right? It's all these little yeah. occurrences in your life that get you to where you are today. And so that was part of it.
No, that Australia is an interesting place. And you talk about 2.2 million acres, right? That's just a size that we can't really imagine here in the U.S. for a ranching operation. But having been there a couple of times in the cotton space doing some sensor testing in Narrabri, man, I mean, it is just from, I think I flew into Brisbane and drove 7 or 8 hours northwest or more west into Narrabri. I mean, there were hours at a time where there's nothing, no town, no gas station, very few cars coming the other direction. I mean, it can be an austere place where you can aggregate just huge swaths of land that we can't really imagine here in the U.S. So, so that was your King Ranch on your dad's side, but you mentioned your mom also in the ranching space. Give us some perspective from that, if you would.
Sure. Yeah. So Beggs Cattle Company first started in 1876. Another connection that's distant, but two brothers, one came to America or Texas, one went to Australia, and there's still Beggs ranching down there too, even though I don't know them. But so that would be George Beggs the first. And my uncle is George Beggs the fourth, and the other uncle is Ed Farmer Beggs. And so, you know, the fourth generation management, I'm fifth generation there. It's more of a traditional cattle ranch, Hereford, Santa Gertrudis cross cattle, really good horse program, Northwest Texas up there, southeast of Lubbock, and then some country on the west side of Fort Worth too. And we've been on those ranches for around just about 100 years, you know, plus or minus on each one. Cause at first we were leasing country and doing some different things in the early days of the business. But, you know, we're exploring. One thing that's fun for me too is King Ranch is kind of a diversified operation and is in a lot of different things. And again, Beggs is, like I said, more traditional, but there's an ability to learn from the mistakes and the opportunities that King Ranch has, and then take those lessons over to Beggs. And, but it's a much smaller family, and it's a little bit far from where I am now, but I try to get up there as often as I can to help out and everything too.
So you're in a leadership capacity, or at least you're on the board. And I think you said you run their hunting operations on Beggs. Is that right?
That's right. We stood up a family board a few years ago to go through again, like any typical board does. And then yes, my uncle George had a hunting operation out there, and I just asked if I could be involved with that, just because South Texas, where I am, and again, I worked at King Ranch for 10 years and got to be exposed to a pretty sophisticated hunting operation down here. And so I just asked if I could work on that a little bit on commercial day hunts and leases, right, and those kind of things. And he's allowed me to do so, and we've made some progress, but it's obviously very different from South Texas. I tell people that Australia is as different from South or West Texas as South or West Texas are from each other. And so, you know, the culture changes, the stocking rates, the type and quantity of wildlife, and also the reliability of wildlife too, you know, in different places. Is you can't just, people think you can just take that playbook and move it over here for the same operation. Yeah. And so it's a learning process. And, but it's, you know, part of it. And also you get to where, because we've already adjusted all of these carrying capacities of land, mostly because of the sprawl of these cities and stuff, you have to manage your wildlife populations similar to your cattle operations. And so even though it's fair chase, low fence, and, you know, come and go type deal, they still provide an impact on your soil health, your forage, et cetera. And so not only is it something that you can make some added revenue on, but it's also something to for the overall health of your operation. We find ourselves in a unique position because the demand, you know, the demand for hunting in South Texas is pretty intense. And so at times you can find people that can't quite afford or don't need the quantity of a South Texas and then offer them another opportunity. And yeah, I mean, again, I'm fortunate for a number of reasons, but just to be around people that are very sophisticated in their hunting and wildlife and conservation and ag operations in general, like I can pick up the phone and get advice and possibly get customers from a lot of other folks too. But for a large majority of the people out there, services like land trust, like you just said, are becoming more and more viable because not everybody can you know, just wake up and have a network just because they own land. And that's why you see so much land changing hands, is that it's honestly not the work ethic or the ability of the person managing. It's just, they don't know where to go to find those answers. And you're finding a lot of people fill that gap. You probably saw, we talked about it too. My dad started a company called the Land Board that actually fulfills that opportunity for a lot of people too, just be from a lot of the lessons he learned with King Ranch and with our other family operations and that kind of thing too. So I think that's, like we talked about also, I think in our previous call, you can't ranch like your ancestors did and expect to make money. You can make money, but expect to make a living like they did. And so you've got to be more, you've got to think outside the box more often.
22 years old, enlisted in the Marine Corps. What year was that?
2008.
Okay. Walk us through some of those early years.
Yeah, so just boot camp, and honestly, my enlisted time was, I mishandled it, I guess. I went to boot camp, came out, did my reserve duty, and I was just thinking that, and during boot camp, I'd already had a college degree, so they tried to recruit me for OCS, and they were like, hey, right out of boot camp, go to OCS. And when you're halfway through boot camp, that sounds like a horrible idea.
Yeah.
Yes, in hindsight, like what a small deal. But I wish I'd had asked more questions prior to. But really, it just a few years later, I just got frustrated with just not doing what I wanted to accomplish. And I was already getting older. So then when I was 26, I went – 26, 27 ish, I went to OCS and became an infantry officer. So did that whole year in Quantico. And then I went out to the West Coast with a first light armored reconnaissance for a few months. And then I got moved over to 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines in 29 Palms and went with them to Afghanistan and as a platoon commander. And that was everything you'd want to do as a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. And my men did an awesome job. You know, the funny part was I was added to that roster so late that I was learning my guys' names, like on the plane, on the bus ride, on the plane ride, and even at Camp Leatherneck before we got pushed out to our PB. And so, but, you know, I think, you know, the Marine Corps, what they teach you in Quantico does give you the tools, right, to accomplish it. And so even with that little wrinkle there, we had a really good group of guys and had a ball, and then came back from that. What's that?
What year was that?
That was okay, let's see, 10 to 11,
right?
I was in Quantico, and then 11 and 12, I was in Afghanistan. I always say that wrong. I think it was actually 11, 12, 12, 13.
I know. Those times sort of all run together. And you said you were 2-7, right?
2-7, yes.
Where were they?
We were, so 2-7 was spread out across Helmand, but we were actually the RBE. And that was, if you remember, when those guys infiltrated Leatherneck and blew up a jet. And so they all of a sudden, you know, they got told, hey, we need to send another debt down there, another company, to provide added security for Leatherneck Base and then the surrounding areas. And that's why I got thrown into that mission, because they needed lieutenants to go fill gaps. But that was also funny, too. Like, you know, with an RBE, it was like half guys that were brand new and half guys that didn't want to go anymore.
Right.
And so, you know, great, you know, training there to be able to get both those guys dedicated. It came with the normal issues of guys just kind of not believing in it anymore on some fronts. And then some guys were so motivated, but everything you'd want to do, we got to do all the mounted, dismounted patrols. We got to do all the raids and stuff, looking for bad guys. We were actually at PB Boldak. Some of your listeners might remember that place. Got to work with Australians, British, Danish. Jordanians. Jordanians actually guarded our posts while we were out and pushed out. And we were just north, you know, it was fantastic. And then, so I've gotten to the transition, you know, finished my time in working with 2-7 and everything, eventually transitioned back to reserves. Well, right before then, went to South America and did a MIT team training troops down there in Chile, a bunch of different countries that worked together, and then transitioned to the reserves. And so got to go second lieutenant, first lieutenant, and then as a captain, I got to go with a 4th Force Reconnaissance down to Mexico to train Mexican Marines and work with them on some things. And that was also a great experience. I got to go to Latin America twice, and I love my time spent down there. And then,
how on earth did you get plugged into a MIT team headed to Chile for Chilean forces training?
I besides the last deployment, the fourth one, the fourth activation, if you will, right. I volunteered for everything. I remember to do that deal in Afghanistan, the XO, and I will forget his name, but the XO first LAR brought me in and said, hey, because I, you know, all of us want to go to Afghanistan at that point, right? And he brings me in, he goes, do you want to go to Afghanistan still? I was just, you know, been with my platoon a few months and was, you know, all into that. And I was like, yes, I do. And he goes, okay, well, you got to tell me for sure. And if you do, you leave in 2 days to go to 29 Palms. And, you know, I remember calling my dad, my brother, and was like, yeah, this is why we sign up, you know, and then gave a goodbye to these guys. I just, you know, was all in as a platoon commander, but kind of better deal than, which, you know, feel a little bit bad about that thinking back in hindsight, but, you know, needs the core too. So, and then went over there. And then for the Chilean deal too, it was like, hey, do you want to go on this deal? And I was like, yes. And so got thrown into that. And then the Mexican deal too, there was a little bit of a, not to, you know, some issues went down and they were scrambling to find somebody. And so I said, absolutely. And they were like, oh, are you sure? And I was like, yes. It was five or so months going down there to finish the time period with these guys. Those guys were awesome. That was my team there. But then I had to wait for like 6 weeks because they were on a down cycle. So they were going to come home and have a little rest and then go back. And they, in the course of that, they were like, hey, we need a guy. God, we need somebody to take 30 Mexican lieutenants that just graduated their Naval Academy. They're going to be their Mexican Marine, their entire Mexican Marine class, to tour them through battle sites on the East Coast, starting at Paris Island, going through boot camp for a while, then spending 3 weeks on a bus going to Civil War and Revolutionary War memorial sites, going to where the Wright brothers did their first flight, going to Quantico, I was like, how do you not have people volunteering for this?
Yeah, right.
And they're like, do you want to go? And they were like, yes. And I said, yes. And they're like, do you speak Spanish? And I was like, working Spanish. And they were like, you're in. And so the first 5 days, I went to boot camp in San Diego. So that was my first time at Parris Island. And there was a Hispanic staff sergeant, and I'm not good with names, but she learned all of her order, you know, basic daily routine in Spanish and practiced it. And she treated them like recruits for 4 days, all in Spanish, hammered
Oh,
on them,
boy.
made them run. And these guys had just finished the Mexican Naval Academy. So they were kind of like, wait, aren't we done with this thing? And,
Right.
And so they, but she went through it. She did an awesome job. They went through like a little taste of boot camp all the way around. And then we're in this, we had a private bus. We kept making these stops. And the first week I'm like trying to do all this in Spanish, like trying to translate what the tour guide's saying to these guys. And like a week in, one of the guy, I'm seeking a word. I'm like looking up, and the guy tells me the word in English. One of these guys, I was like, you guys speak English? And they were like, well, about half of us do. And I was like, you can, okay, we're going to break into two groups.
Yeah,
those
right.
that are bilingual are going to do this, and I'm just going to enjoy my time here. And but we got to get, we got to sit on the front row for the silent drill platoon at 8th and I too.
Yeah.
Mad Dog Mattis walks by me, you know, got to shake his hand. I mean, it's just like, it was an unbelievable 3 weeks. And then I went down to Mexico and actually worked with some of these guys, or no, I got to watch them graduate their Naval Academy, and then worked with not those guys, but the guys a year older than them that were in their first platoons and really stand up. Yeah, it's been enough years back. So stand up their kind of reconnaissance community and
Right.
a lot of their amphibious operations. And it was a really great time. And, but yeah, then came back from that. And then a few years later did get, involuntary ordered to go to, Blackstone, Virginia for the Afghan refugee mission. So, you know, I got to do a company. Now I'm a major. So I've gotten to go somewhere at every rank. And I got to take 100 Marines, a company, you know, a company reduced, and ran a 3,000 man refugee camp, both sexes, in an old World War II, basically POW area that had been converted and updated. It wasn't by any means like that. And so got to transition 3,000 Afghans, getting off the bus from Afghanistan after they'd been kind of vetted in Europe, came here, went through the process with us of vetting. And my guys were teaching them. Now I'm with Carlos Company 123, which was a company I was with a long time in the reserves. Mm-hmm. And now we're teaching them taxes. We're teaching them American culture. We're teaching
what?
Them legal. Yeah. I mean, and we made all this up as we went, because it was like, we were like, where are these guys going? And it's like, oh, they're going to Kansas and Oklahoma. I was like, you're taking people that don't speak English into a place where there's going to be nobody that speaks any language that they might have any idea on. And so we're just hammering through all these topics as quickly as possible, and then kind of saying good luck and sending them on their way. And it was a little bit of closing a chapter, right? Because I remember when I got to Afghanistan, you know, and you go there and you're second lieutenant and you're trying to give the talk to all the elders about like how committed we are to you. And he's like, look, man, you're the like 15th guy that's told me
right.
that. Yeah. Right. And you realize, yeah, God. But then in Virginia, it was actually pretty satisfying to be able to say, you are going to go live a peaceful life. And I will be the last Marine officer that you, or we will be the last Marines that you see until you go live your new life. And we actually honored that promise, which, you know, I won't get into how we got to that position, but at least we made lemonade out of the lemon that was that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then now with command and staff. So that's kind of snapshot, you know, schools and other things throughout. But that's basically what I've done.
And then from there, you're sort of back in the civilian world, and then in the reserves as you go to command and staff.
Sure. And so I just went through kind of reserve time, because I've been, you know, 11 years back ranching full time. And reserve Marines minus those jaunts we just discussed. And
ranching full time at King Ranch?
Yeah, well, so I came home from 2-7 and went back to reserves at 123 and came to work for a guy named Steve Knudsen, who was the horse manager at King Ranch. I'd worked in every cow camp on King Ranch, which is 11, but there's not many people that can say that. Some as little as 2 months, but as long as a year. So that was kind of, you know, all that. But the only camp I hadn't worked in was the horse camp there at headquarters. And Steve Knudsen was there. Steve was from South Dakota. He worked in Colorado. And a guy named Buster Welch saw him up there. And Buster told Stanley Glover, that was his boss, if that guy ever quits you, I'd like to hire him. And he did. And Buster did. Buster was now at King Ranch. This is 1976. And Steve worked for King Ranch basically from then until, and then I'm now there 2013, 2014, maybe. Yeah. 2014. And then Steve, so I work with him, you know, not even 2 years. And then Steve turns to me at end of 15 and says, well, I'm going to retire. Do you want my job? And to run the King Ranch Horse Division, I was kind of flattened. It's kind of like that same deal. Do you want to go to Afghanistan? Good. You leave in 2 days.
Right. Do
you want to run one of those famous horse operations in the world? Make a decision now, or we're going to go hire somebody. And I was like, yes. And so I spent, until about 22, 20. Yeah. So when I was right before that Virginia deal, I'd kind of handed over. So say 21, late 21, I'd handed over the horse operation to the new manager. So from 15 to 21, I was the manager there. And, so supplying horses for about 35 King Ranch Cowboys, promoting stallions in a program, selling horses in an annual sale that we developed back, and just marketing the horses as part of the overall brand of King Ranch. And then getting to work with a bunch of great horse trainers, great cowboys, and just learn that whole industry. And it was incredible. And I got to work. The most fun part for me was probably because King Ranch was like a generation of, in the early 90s, we slowed down our horse program from where it was in the 80s, which was hundreds of mares getting bred in the 80s. And we shot that down to less than 100 in a short period of time, selling off stuff and everything, and reduced our marketing, reduced a lot of things. And so what I got to do from 15 to 21 was basically re-establish relationships with a lot of the folks that had been part of King Ranch, either directly or indirectly, and help grow that brand back with a great team. But what I tell people is, look, the horses were there. The bloodlines had actually kind of been developed in a vacuum because we had not, you know, been part of the updates and the overall other ranching culture. So we started to buy some horses and breed to some horses that were outside and had updated genetics, but went back to King Ranch historic breeding and try to, you know, again, update the overall genetic pool while not sacrificing what kept us unique and provided the best horses for the cowboys on King Ranch for day-to-day operations. And so, you know, people, horses, history, tying it all together and kind of a reintroduction for a lot of it. And it was great. And then towards the end of my tenure at King Ranch, the last 2 or 3 years, I went to go work. They called me land resource manager. I was a land man, but so I worked on fence lines, power lines, pipelines, oil and gas, everything that's going on King Ranch, but also renewables and kind of all the new business opportunities. And so carbon too, both a small part in a possible direct air capture project, and then also on a soil carbon study. And so I handed over the horse program to Leroy in 21, I guess, Leroy Montalvo, who's a friend. And also he's a seventh generation descendant. His ancestor came up from Mexico with my great-great-grandfather, Captain King. And so his family had been there as long as my family basically had been there. And so it was really special to me for him to take that operation over, and he's doing a great job. And then, and that was, I think, always probably the plan. It was never to stay in the horse program forever. It was to try to solve some issues or put it back on a path and then hand it over, which is kind of like a, you know, a Marine billet, right? And so that there's so many comparisons you can make between ranching and military life. And I think you and I talked about that a little bit before, but culturally, personality wise, expectations, I think all are very similar, even though the specific, you know, tactical skills might be slightly different, but, you know, the will being the most important part is also very, very similar between the two.
Man, we haven't even talked about ag tech yet.
Yeah, that's right. I was supposed to come on here and talk about that. So we'll screw up.
Look, how on earth did you start to get into ag tech, and how'd you end up at Earth Optics?
Absolutely. So Earth Optics was doing a Exxon funded study through B Carbon out of Rice University, Jim Blackburn, who was at B Carbon. And they were testing soil organic carbon on ranches from South Texas all the way to North Dakota. About 30,000 acres being sampled each year over a 3-year period. But those 30,000 acres are pieces of what might be as much as 30 million acres, because it's much larger operations, but they're doing like a sample set on each piece. And so not with practice changes, with just with a real baseline saying like, hey, with no deliberate plan and process to make a difference on this land, just what does it look like? And so I'm on the job with Lars Dierud, and I'm asking him all these questions about soil organic carbon, carbon markets. And I've already been studying this for a while because I was looking about enrolling on a ranch that I manage in South Texas, separate from all these full-time gigs where I run my personal cows, and we're expanding that. But, and he answers every question. Lars is an astrophysicist. He's already sold two companies to Google Earth. And his goal is to be the Google Earth of soil. And 2 months later, I called him and asked him for a job, because I was like, you know, multiple things are coming together here with this whole concept. One, efficiencies to make ranches more productive, more cost effective, you know, tighter, everything. And so, you know, ag tech can help that. You know, that's the obvious thing. But with the soil carbon in particular, and all the other things that we are testing at Earth Optics, everything below your feet is what we say, biology, fertility, compaction, moisture, et cetera, is we're now bringing together the beef eating ranching community and the as you know, climate activists, tree huggers, two groups that have usually at odds with how they think of the world. But we're proving that, like, look, grazing is good for the world. It's good for the soil. It's good for ecosystems. It helps regulate temperatures, extreme weathers, et cetera, because what happens on the soil affects what happens in the sky and vice versa. And so now they're coming together. The other thing is private landowners and government, BLM land and NGO operations like U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Audubon World Wildlife. Again, two groups that were usually apart from each other. Now they're being brought together. And so, like, with this discussion, you can now say that, like, this conversation on soil can bring all these players that never had anything in common together. And in the idea that we must protect our soils, we must do better by our soils, we must prevent more cement being dropped on top of our soils. Somebody told me the other day, and I shared an article to some people that we put in enough cement on the earth every year to fill up the entire UK with a top layer. And so if we keep thinking, oh, it's airplanes or it's cars or it's, you know, oil and gas that's affecting these ecosystems, it's like we have a much bigger issue with the fact that we keep choking our earth's ability from being able to self-regulate. And so all of that comes together in this conversation. And that's why I love it so much.
And I think you're right about these sort of disparate groups in the past fighting for different causes. And now we're at a place where climate activists and folks that are interested in that are and can and should be in intimate discussions with ranchers and cattlemen, because they're a piece to that restoration puzzle. Lars is the CEO for Earth Optics.
Yes. One more point on that last thing too.
Yeah.
Amos Eno, who's a conservative conservationist from the East Coast, he said the other day, he goes, you know, everybody's obsessed with Yellowstone, for those few months that the animals, the park I'm talking about, that the animals are on the park. But for 8 months of the year, those animals are on private lands. And so the fact that we've tried to avoid the discussion of working with private landowners is absurd for all of the natural wonders of this world, especially the animal life. But and I love that concept too, that it's got to be a handshake. And in Texas in particular, 95% of land in Texas is privately owned. Like, you can't just act like you're going to make a difference on public lands and move along. But so, yes, Lars is the CEO of Earth Optics.
And when you guys, when you interact, when you cross paths with him, they were doing the 30,000 acre sample. What type of instrumentation, how were they sampling that soil for soil organic carbon measurements?
Yeah, so we have a side by side, you know, a Kubota, if you will, that has a few implements on it. So one being what's currently called our ground owl, but it's a soil penetrating radar that can go down to 12 feet in the soil to check soil texture. And I'm glad you asked this, because a lot of people do a lot of these things with modeling. We are where the rubber meets the road. We're actually pulling all the data and confirming it. So it's checking, you know, minutiae elevation changes and everything else going on that a ground penetrating radar could check in the soil. And then we actually have this piston driven, basically almost jackhammer looking thing that can slide a meter core into the soil. And so with a meter core, you can check what could be hundreds, if not thousands of years of soil information. It's like cutting a tree and looking at the rings. But so now you're looking at the top layer of soil, which is the additionality. So photosynthesis adds carbon to the top of the soil. And then as those roots grow, that carbon is shoved deeper and deeper into the soil. So when you take this, you're looking at the additionality and how much carbon is being added on an annual basis, and then also how much carbon is being pushed and stored permanently deep down within the soil. When we do that, we also take photos in the cardinal directions and sometimes of the actual biodiversity biomass on the ground. And then we're also taking a GPS coordinate and an imagery from space. And then any other details that we might observe, because it's an actual human on the ground pulling this information. All of that is taken back to our labs and then not only tested for everything that we want to test, but also stored in case testing becomes more efficient or there's something else you want to test in the future. It's refrigerated and almost, you know, stored in time of where it was when you tested it, so we can go back and retest it for other things down the road. We, you know, this year we're going to hit 3 million acres of soil tested, and we've already measured over 800,000 tons of permanently stored carbon in the soil. And so, you know, I mean, we got to get a lot bigger to keep going, but we're growing like crazy. It took us a year to get to 5,000 acres, and now we'll hit 3 million the first year, and now we'll hit 3 million acres this year. So, I mean, we're scaling quickly. Soil carbon is 80% of our business, because I tell people, like, look, all the infrastructure developments and all the things you want to do as a rancher, at least be selling carbon credits now so that you can pay for all of those inputs. But looking at all the things you can do down the road, you know, for adding water to your water table, or if you're a farmer, you know, checking rootworm eggs and being able to destroy custom those rootworm eggs, an invasive bug species that is detrimental to a crop. Or looking at compaction, how do you relieve compaction over time with, you know, are you running cattle over crop in the off season to kind of add that that manure and add that natural fertilizer into the system to help release that? And so, you know, there's productivity that can be gained in year one in some of these things for testing that costs as much as the testing that people do anyways. There's even another company out of there called Boa Safra that's actually that we're doing the soil sampling now for, that is taking deductions on soil values and being able to quantify that and making it a deduction for your taxes, because you're putting a value on all those soil nutrients, which is an interesting concept too. And so we're just, you know, at the tip of the iceberg here of all the things you can do with that soil data, but all of it adds value to what we can do.
Is the ground penetrating radar to get at bulk density, which is one of the metrics you'll need for soil organic carbon?
Absolutely. Yes. Okay. And there's, as you probably know, but there's varying numbers of bulk density that needs to be checked based on what is the production on the surface level. Right. And then based on what program you're in, with a carbon program.
When you take photos, are you taking photos in that core hole, that 1 meter down that you just pulled?
No. The photos are above surface photos.
Okay.
So and it's looking at, you know, what's the, you know, pounds of forge on the place. We're actually working with another company called Enriched Ag. Have you heard of them yet?
Yes, I have.
So, you know, that they measure everything above ground. We measure everything below ground. And so we're trying to build that relationship between the two, because, you know, as your soil health improves, what levels of soil measurements do you have to get to where the native grasses come back, the native plants come back, the roots start fighting back on those invasive species? Everybody says it gets there one time, but it's very, especially in South Texas with our long growing season, it's not as easy. It's not an overnight thing to achieve those results. And so that's been, you know, as we're building that data set and working and building that relationship, that's interesting too, because, you know, how can we see, you know, what is happening in the soil and what does that mean in terms of amount of worms, amount of birds, butterflies, and then the plant biodiversity. So you know, both the quality and quantity of those plants that are growing above, and all of this is machine learning. So nothing is where a human has to study this.
Right.
It's going into a system and then giving you back information that is actionable. And again, people think, well, it sounds like it's going to cost money. Well, no, it actually can pay you money, because all that can benefit your carbon credits that you're selling in the open space. So you can gain data that can increase your productivity and be paid to take that data. And that's, I mean, on our, the first place I did a carbon measurement in South Texas, we just got paid $8 an acre for ranching the way we were going to ranch anyways. It is a practice change we implemented over the last few years. So it is qualifying practice change. We are under the regenerative standard, you know, per the definition, because of our rotation, because of our proactive measurements, because of what we do create that habitat. But I mean, this is real money, and it's not government. It's being paid from Fortune 500 companies that want to improve their ESG score, increase their you know, credit score, their carbon credit score, whatever you want to say. But there's not a government hand in this space.
Right.
And so I think it's a great opportunity. I wouldn't sacrifice the integrity of my family's operations for something that I thought was a fly by night.
Right.
I've told my boss before, if I ever feel like this doesn't benefit the landowner, I'm out.
It's a fair point, because sometimes there's a fair amount of greenwashing when it comes to the modelings that are used to feed the credit system. And I've always been a proponent that garbage into those things and garbage out, right? So the more that you can gather information from the actual soil and the ground itself to feed these systems that enable the value of these credits, the better.
Absolutely.
When you're pushing this piston down, you're collecting basically a soil sample core, right? And then you're gathering your GPS point on it, surface level photos, space imagery of that. And then you're categorizing that core by that GPS point. And then you're having a third party lab analyze that soil sample, or do you guys do that internally?
Both.
Okay.
We just acquired a company called Pattern Ag, which was a soil biology and fertility company. So now we can scale that also more on the agronomy side. They were out of California, but with that came some labs in the US and in Brazil. There's still auditing that goes on in the labs, third party auditing, whether we own the lab or not. But because of our volume, it's tough for a lot of labs to keep up with the amount of samples that we're sending them.
Right.
So we had to kind of own that space as well. The other thing people need to realize is there's multiple levels of auditing going on. There's practice auditing. So like, again, just take the carbon space because it's the most talked about. So it's people that are stepping in like an understanding ag to see what you're actually doing differently or better than, you know, the normal area would do or a normal practitioner would do. Then there's also everything we do in terms of actual soil sampling and lab work. Then there's a developer that's kind of patching the first two things together. But then there's also a third party verifier. Climate Action Reserve, the Gold Standard, Vera. These are a few of those out there. So they're the ones that take your tons of carbon that you're measuring, and a ton equals a credit, but they still have to go through a rigorous protocol to make sure that everything you're telling them is living up to what their expectations. This is an unregulated market, which, you know, again, another thing military guys like, right? You know, not that overarching theme. It's still, but you know, my friends that are in this space want to achieve regulation because it'll add value to the space. But it's pretty fun right now being in an unregulated, not voluntary market, which is different than our friends in Australia and some other countries that are now being mandated to do some of this stuff. But yeah, when regulation occurs, it will spike these prices. But it's pretty fun doing it right now.
For those who may be interested, because of the point you just made about the dollar per acre that's available, how do you guys price your services for the work you do?
So we price at about $5 an acre. With some of the protocols that are happening, it's making us kind of squeak up to $6-7 an acre. But say 5 to 10 is the range. What's a ton of carbon worth? So again, let's just take my example. So I'm working on a $20 ton of carbon, $22 ton on a short-term conversion here, and I'm getting 50%. So my contract is making about $11 an acre every year, but it's growing because we'll see an increase over time in these credits.
So in that example, right, where you have a contract with a buyer for $22 per ton of carbon, right? And then you would need to then verify how much carbon is available per your acre. So let's say they would contract with you guys for $10 an acre to do the assessment. So their profit with anything without anything else would be $12 per acre as a margin in that contract. Is that, sure. Am I generally sort of getting that flow correct?
Yeah, but one is, you know, nobody ever puts their time value, right? So you know, what's your time worth, all that? Right. Two, a very tangible cost is verification. So it's not free to submit all of these things. They're going to charge you for their auditing process too, because that's how Climate Action Reserve makes their money. So a reduction there. You also have expertise. You need expertise to model, because when you're selling what's called an interim carbon credit, you're basically saying, because James ranches the way he does, because of the rainfall soil type and the carbon data that we collected, we are now assuming an increase of this over time. And then at the end of that period, you have to get to where you get to a net gain or loss based on that. And so it takes, you know, your example's sound, but there's a lot more that comes into play to subtract from your margin. And there's a lot of, it's not quite realistic at this point because of the price of credits. Now, credits in other countries are 100, 120, $150 a ton. When these credits are worth that, you're going to see smaller and smaller ranchers be able to play in this space, right, and more independence being offered. Because if you're gaining a ton of carbon an acre and you have 10,000 acres and it's $100 a ton, you're now talking about significant reason for a buyer to look at you at 10,000 acre vice 100,000 acre, because they can pick up a significant amount of credits. But then you as a buyer to also say, hey, I don't want somebody chopping into this margin too much, because this is real money.
Yeah. So in that example, though, let's say I've only got 100 acres. Do I need a data point? Do I need a data point from you guys, for example, per acre, in order for me to qualify for any sort of contract or even to make it worth the verification process? Or can I say, look, based on mapping data for these 5 acres, irrigation is similar, it's flat, soil profile doesn't change, one data point for 5 acres is sufficient. In this area where I've got a tremendous amount more variability, I might need 2 data points per acre.
Yeah, I appreciate the way you're breaking this out. So, you know, generally we take every 70 acres, we get a point. But if you had 70 acres, doesn't mean we can get 1 point. You know, that's based on the scale and all the factors you said, similarity of soils, elevations, et cetera. And so there's a lot of what ifs depending on where you are, what your soil is, et cetera. But the other thing too is, if you have 100 acres, it's very tough with the current state of markets to be able to make that call. But the thing that is being developed, I'm actually trying to be a guinea pig on one herd of cattle that I have, is attaching credits to the beef, right? So that's called scope 3 or insetting, right? So it's still quantifying the carbon, but instead of just a soil carbon score, which is again our specialty, but you're also putting a score on the amount of diesel fuel you use, the amount of, you know, electricity you're using to, you know, to run a squeeze chute or to, whatever. And so if you can measure all of those things, and the good news is if you're able to reduce that, you're also reducing your total cost to, you know, of gain or cost per head, et cetera. But you can, it's a two-way street. You can save money, be more profitable over here, but you can also sell more carbon credits because you're gaining a margin over there. There's people out there that are working through these problems and getting through it. The simplest way to do this is through the soil. And I mean, that's where I am, right? So it was deliberate with a lot of advice from a lot of smart people for me to get into this space.
Did you say that you guys typically look at one data point per 70 acres, 70 or 7?
Through 70.
Okay.
The thing that, I don't want that to be the take home message because difficult.
That's why I'm giving you a chance to sort of clarify that.
And so like, I know that it's different averages. It could be 1 to 40, 1 to 50. So, but we can basically sample about 1,000 acres a day. Our peak was 4,000 acres in a day that I've heard on ranch land, on farmland, which is the other side of the house, is a little bit different. So, you know, I'd have to bring that in, but it is low impact. The trucks don't get off the roads. The only thing that goes out in the field is a side by side. I tell people, if you didn't know we were there, you wouldn't know we were there, because it's such low impact to your land.
It's a tiny hole.
Exactly. It is. One customer was concerned about us filling the holes back up after they are pulled. But it's like, look, you might have an inch of an actual indention because the soil falls back immediately as we pull it out. You know, it's because he was worried about, you know, injury to animals. And I was like, it won't be an issue.
You're not going to get a cow's foot stuck in that hole. I mean, I imagine you're like an inch, right? You've got a 1-inch diameter on that hole.
Exactly. Yeah, it is an inch and a meter long, an inch wide. And then what's cool too is we cut that tube on either side and seal it. So if that shakes up in the mail as it's going.
I was going to ask how you did that, because I thought you would have, what I've done in the past on the 18-inch ones, you just thumb them out into a bag. Right, you can kind of aggregate them, or you can label it by GPS point, but you're keeping the core intact so you can measure the profile at different depths potentially.
Exactly. Once it gets to line. Gotcha. So there's less, we're trying to take as much human error out as we can. You're right. That absolutely could work, sliding out those each individual pieces. Yeah. One, it slows us down.
Yeah.
Two, there's a potential for just missing, you know, that crucial centimeter or inch or whatever, just with that human thumb issue, you know?
Right.
People don't get as excited as I do about that, but I thought that was really interesting because like mailing all these tubes, and retaining that soil in that regard is pretty interesting to me.
So you're somehow able to seal that sample inside of a tube. Is there a vacuum that you pull on it, or just seal it so that those, or are you pulling
both.
A vacuum?
Yeah, both.
Really?
And then cap it. And then, so again, when you get that, that's like you know, when they cut out a profile soil to show you how deep roots are.
Yeah.
That's like you looking at that. You're looking at that top to bottom.
You know, I've heard this before, and I'm curious as to your thoughts at it. In order to truly opine on the soil's ability to sequester that carbon, you have to go down to a meter, right? And there are groups that are looking at doing soil organic and inorganic measurements at depths less than that. I mean, is that right? Is that wrong? Why did you guys make the decision to go as deep as you did?
So I'm not going to chime in on right or wrong because it's protocol dependent, and I'm not smart enough to have that argument. We do take 12-inch samples and meter samples because if you think about it, and it's based on bulk density sample density too,
right?
Correct? But if you think about it, that top layer of soil, how often do we hear that the top layer is the skin, right? Sometimes all we want to test is the skin to see how protective it is. And then sometimes we want to see the permanence. And so, but the top layer, that top 12 inches, is showing you the additionality score. So how much carbon is entering the soil, but not necessarily storing permanently. But that, if you're selling an additionality-based carbon credit, most of your measurements only need to be additionality, but we still take a meter core ever so often, even on those samplings, to prove that permanence is still happening for the longer term conversation.
Got it.
Some people, though, want to do only meter cores. And then some people say that's a waste of time and money because you don't need to be able to check that as long as you're getting an additionality score. I'm in the middle. My name's Paul. This between y'all. I'm not going to chime in on that because that is really for the protocol people and the scientists to hammer that conversation out.
Got it. That makes sense, though.
Look, a friend of mine said, you're selling pickaxes to the miners. That's us.
Right. Like,
we're not here to tell you how to chop into the mine. We're here to give you all the tools to be able to service this whole industry. And I like being in that space because there's a whole conversation about the development of where these industries go monetarily, but we are part of doing the best, most efficient, most cost-effective technology to service all those industries. And I like being in that space.
Does the carbon market make a distinction between an additionality score or value versus a permanence score or value relative to
they
carbon?
Do, but they usually instead of separating it, they usually add value to the credit. So if you can
demonstrate a permanence on top of an additionality.
Exactly. And that's why some people like the meter core, because what if somebody was intentionally working on just trying to improve additionality, but not storing?
Right.
Now, if you really thought through that, the time and money and effort spent doing that would not be worth any value of carbon credits, because you'd be adding topsoil layers all over your place all the time. The other thing, we don't give an exact 10-digit grid to our landowners just in case they're going to go and, you know, fertilize those spots where they're sampling. We give them a general area so they know, but it's a randomized set of points. Well, it's not randomized. It's sent to us in what looks randomized, but it's actually based on the soil swirls and the soil types and the elevation types. So then we're able to say, okay, based on the type of soil and what that elevation is, you need a sample here. It's increased elevation, but similar soil, so take it here. It's different soil, but same elevation, take a soil sample here. And so you're getting that bigger picture spread out across.
But you guys generate that sample profile ahead of a new client, for example?
Yes. So we can do a desktop analysis too and say, so our COO, he told me one time, he goes, our goal is to get to where we don't have to take soil samples. And I was like, how do you see that? He goes, well, every soil sample we take teaches our machine, our AI.
Right.
What based on rainfall, elevation, soil type, management criteria, above ground biomass, everything you can see from imagery and everything you've got underground, that in the future, we'll take less and less soil samples and eventually maybe zero because we'll have that data. So our desktop analysis is getting more and more refined. Now, we won't give the rancher the plan before we're paid to do the job, because then the rancher might say, well, I'm just going to do it myself, which would be a risk because there's a lot more going on than just pulling meter cores here. But that's that thinking.
That's really interesting because, I'm thinking about this. I'm still thinking about the cost benefit analysis of whether or not adding a permanence cap, if you will, would be worth the extra money or time for a rancher instead of just an additionality score. But again, circumstances dependent. But then I'm also thinking about the cost for a group like yours to have a piece of equipment that goes out on a regular basis and pulls these cores. And so it's interesting to hear you say that in the future, you all are looking towards a model, a business model, not an algorithmic model at this point, but a business model that says, we have learned enough about the soil given these other input parameters to feel pretty confident that what we're going to find in the ground is what everything else is telling us. We might confirm or spot check every now and then, but we can then sort of sideline or use in other capacities these more equipment heavy requirements of soil organic measurement systems.
Yeah, so you see it's a swelling of field technicians over time and then a reduction. But the other thing too is like South Texas, for example, there's a lot of tree canopy, a lot of brush.
Yeah, so you can't get at the soil because of that, especially if
exactly.
You're
and so that's why the enriched ag thing and why continuously finding above ground data is also important, because as that tree growth happens, okay, like we have guinea grass in South Texas, which grows like crazy underneath those trees, grows quickly to 3 foot tall and then kind of falls apart and it loses its protein quickly and it doesn't have as deep seated of a root as a native grass. So to the untrained eye, you might count a bunch of above ground biomass, but that doesn't that won't increase your carbon score by a lot. Your additionality score is directly related to the amount of pounds of grass you're growing every year, right? Because photosynthesis, carbon in, grass out. And so that is how you're making the cycle happen. We're also learning, like people always say, well, my ranch is in Kentucky. What do you think? It's like, I can't make that hip call yet. Yeah, you know, maybe one day.
Right.
Yeah, generally, I said, you know, a general idea is like for every 10 inches of rain, you're looking at maybe a quarter ton additional carbon per year, if well managed. But that's a big if too. You know, what do you call well managed? What do I call it? And frankly, it's not an opinion. It's based on the soil data.
Right.
So I can't just make you that call for no reason. And so like, and again, then the other thing is, as you know, just like in running cattle on high rainfall areas, there's a point where rainfall is actually a detriment to your soil quality because the grass is growing too quickly and not picking up nitrogen and not sucking enough carbon into the ground. And so like in Florida, they say a cow can be belly deep in grass and starving to death because she can eat all day, but she's not getting any nutrients out of that. And that's why they have to put more inputs into there.
Wow.
Yeah. So everybody always asks that. And I've literally talked to 150 plus million acres. I added it up the other day. Some of that's government, some of it's NGO, some of it, a lot of it's private parks, all sorts of things. And it's like, please don't make me try to just guess what your carbon score is. Like there's so many more people involved. Yeah. Now, will it be possible one day? Yeah, but we're not there yet. With 3 million acres, you know, what's the plains of North America are like 250 million acres at this point. And so it's like, don't make me make a claim on what that looks like right now.
Yeah. Oh man, I feel like we could chat for another hour. James, I mean, I got to be respectful of your time. It's been a true pleasure. I've really enjoyed our conversation and for getting to know you. I'm certain this won't be the last time we chat. There's lots of other things that I want to talk about, not just relative to the ag side, but also the military and ag intersection with some of the projects that you're working on as well. I want to give you the last couple of words, though. The first would be, is there anything that I haven't asked you that I should have?
We covered too much for me to try to pontificate on that. But I really appreciate what you're doing, Mike, and that whole, you know, military to ag, ag to military, that, I mean, we're getting to where there's less people you can rely on to do the difficult jobs in this world. So I appreciate what you're doing. And if I could be of service to your community or this community at large, like this needs to be a back and forth forever.
Yeah.
There's even one other group, I guess there's two, Ian McAlpine and Eric Shaja I think you and I talked about it. Yeah. Have you had them on yet or you're going
no,
to?
No, not yet. I'm going to reach out.
Okay. So like a great example, those guys did not have an ag background. They in the Army, they went through the Navy postgraduate school and they just did a paper on regenerative granting for biosecurity and for general just, you know, American security, because if we can't feed ourselves, and you see all these countries, there's a great book called Dirt about the decay of civilizations, the direct relationship to the decay of soil, and the FDR quote, a nation doesn't take care of their soil cannot take care of themselves. And you're seeing this gap be bridged, how we send troops to more austere locations where they can be self-sustaining without a huge logistics footprint. Mm-hmm. That not only is a security issue, because you don't see those, you know, log trains getting blown up, moving out to those people. And so it's less observation from the enemy, less observation for the enemy to thwart that. But it's also that ability for, we're building better humans, right? Because a human that can protect itself, feed itself, and be self-sustaining, is less reliant on all these other bodies that have cropped up over the years to take care of us, because we've lost the ability to take care of ourselves. And so I, again, more reasons why this is all coming together for me, and why I think it's such a great discussion to be having.
The strategic approaches of in-field soil measurement and monitoring device companies seems as varied as the soil itself. Some believe there are areas in a field, for example, that have 100 pounds of free nitrogen coming from the organic matter, and maybe just a few feet away, sandier soils that produce very little nitrogen. The thought is that it would be foolish and short-sighted to treat these the same. Then you have the opposite perspective, like those shared by the COO of Earth Optics, where their goal is perhaps to never have to take soil samples again. It was fascinating to hear James unpack this perspective from Earth Optics and find out more about how they're using a variety of these different technology methods and machine learning to regularly improve their final product. Will it ultimately be enough to never have to sample again? No one knows, but it'll certainly be interesting to follow this development. If you'd like to find out more about Earth Optics, you can find them online at earthoptics.com. James is also very active on LinkedIn under his name, as well as Bloody Buckets Cattle Company.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag Podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Desa, and until next time, stay frosty.